Welcome to the Veterans in Ag podcast, brought to you by AGD Consulting. I'm your host, Mike Desah, and here we explore the stories and insights from the military veteran and supporter communities who are leading the way for vets in agribusiness, ag tech, and agripreneurship. We swap stories, talk ag, and show how the grassroots nature of the ag community can be a natural fit for the military veteran. My guest today is Chris Narayanan, an Extension Farm Management Specialist at the University of Tennessee Institute for Agriculture. Educated at my alma mater, Texas A&M, in Ag Economics, Chris also has a Master's in Range Land Ecology and Management, as well as an MBA from the University of Texas. He spent the next 10 years as a Marine Corps Infantry Officer following his education. After service, he joined the private ag sector and has been working for ag consulting firms, brokerages, and agribusinesses for the last 15-plus years. His career experience spans Wall Street investment banks, hedge funds, and agribusinesses like John Deere and INTL FC Stone. In this episode, Chris brought such a broad perspective from his many different roles in ag that I think has a little bit of everything for everyone. One of my favorite parts of the interview was listening to Chris describe what he calls kitchen table moments. I think this is something many transitioning veterans seek, but struggle to find, after they leave active duty service. A way to connect with their profession in a way that is meaningful and service-based. Have a listen and find out how Chris has finally found this balance. There's a bit of a gap, I would say, between when you were doing some internship in commodity trading towards the end of your college career, and then you step in the Marine Corps from there. Right. And you've got a fair number of years in the Marine Corps. What kept that passion for agriculture alive for you in the service? Was there anything in particular that you experienced over brought it back to center for you?
I don't think there's anything that brought it back. I don't think it ever left, to be honest. Mm-hmm. And I guess, you know, I could answer that in two ways. One is the cheesy kind of classical education version where the warrior comes home, puts his sword down and picks up a plow and gets back to work. Sure. On the farm. And so I kind of had that romanticized idea that I would go stay in the Marines, you know, for however long they would let me and then come back and work in agriculture. So that was kind of always the plan. Now how I would work in ag obviously has evolved over time. And it continued to evolve after that as well. But there was never anything that, I guess, wavered that. That was always the plan. I just didn't quite always know what that was going to look like, but it was something that I want to make happen.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. I think that, I've seen certainly in the last couple of years as well that there's a very natural transition from the veteran from an active duty service member into agriculture, right? But when we think agriculture, the thought generally tends to go to production ag, right? Farming and hands in the dirt and, you know, those kinds of things, right? But from your background in particular, there's a ton more that I think the veteran has from skills that they've developed in the service that can be applied towards the broader ag community, right? So I guess I would ask you, do you agree with that sentiment that the veteran brings much more to the ag community than just inability to produce product, right? Can they have applications in business and economics and management, right?
And you're absolutely right, because you did a much better job on my bio than I ever could, but from working for John Deere to investment banks, and all agribusiness focused just in different ways. So for example, John Deere, my role there was in the risk management, trying to develop risk products and services to John Deere's non-equipment consumer base, right? So it could be elevators, it could be Or I should say non-equipment products and services. Anybody could use it. It could be at the farm level. It could be in the merchandising or processing level. It could be anywhere in that supply chain. But it was basically trying to develop things that beyond the scope of what people think of at John Deere. So there was a lot of, certainly you had to be able to, you know, had a decent quantitative background and being able to crunch numbers, but there's just, you know, a certain amount of strategic and tactical thinking that goes along with it, right? Because looking at these, you know, things like second and third order effects that we harp on in the military to the lowest possible level, you know, is all the more important in the business world, right? Because you are trying to get to a certain point. And I would always, I guess, frame situations very similar to what it was in the military. You know, what's the situation? What are we trying to do? What, you know, how do we get there? And how do we actually execute this thing? What resources do we need? And ultimately, how are we going to be held accountable? And where does the buck stop? And so, you know, when you work in very, you know, similar mindsets, it just makes things a little bit easier to organize yourself and being able to organize a team. Certainly, and there's going to be times when you are just a member of the team, but the insight that you have, the critical reasoning, the critical analysis, and that you've been exposed to in the military, certainly come into play. Because, I mean, we, especially in the Marine Corps, but in the military as a whole, you know, we push leadership down to very, very low levels in terms of age, right?
And right,
we have young folks with a lot more responsibility than their counterparts in the military or in the civilian world. And so when they come out, they've got a leg up. You know, now obviously you can't let your ego come into play. And I'll be honest, I did. You know, thought I, you know, came out and knew everything because, you know, I was just over and above, in my mind anyway, everybody else. But there's still a pecking order. There's still, you know, fiefdoms and I don't want to say politics, but there's other people involved. It's not just about you, right? So that's the challenge. I think a lot of, you know, I certainly did, and I've talked to some other veterans that, you know, sometimes that transition from military to civilian can be a bit challenging in terms of, you know, a perceived lack of structure or
recognition
or something like that. But I think it speaks to the higher ups in the civilian world that can, you know, properly harness that, whether they had military experience or not, because they see a lot of the same qualities that they're looking for out of this veteran who's now transitioning into the civilian world.
Can you recall how you'd mentioned the way that you approached a particular problem solution? Here's the situation. Here's the mission. Here are the risks. Here's the operational structure. And it almost sounded like the way that you had proposed that in the example of John Deere was unique. Can you remember or recall how the presentation of that structure might have differed from the way that a typical agribusiness like Deere, for this case, approached those same kinds of problems? Was it a unique perspective?
No, I wouldn't say it was unique. Maybe it was a unique way of packaging it.
Okay.
You certainly, so one of the things that I've seen in the business world, and this is not John, you know, I mean, I'm not picking on John Deere. It's a great company.
Sure.
But what I've seen in the corporate world as at large is you see a lot of bits and pieces of it. And it's not always, and I think where the disconnect is, all the elements are there. It's just not always packaged in the most efficient or the most understandable way.
Okay.
And so you have a lot of folks that don't see, for lack of a better term, commander's intent. The why, you know, what exactly are we trying to do? You know, the mission isn't to blow the bridge up. It's to deny the enemy supplies. Right.
And you feel like your time in service gave you that unique sense of how to present information as more than just factual, right? That there was the need to communicate an intent behind an action or behind an initiative rather than just what needed to be done to get it done.
And I think, you know, because, I mean, we have them in the military. We have clock punchers in the military. They just want to,
you know,
they want to punch out at 16:30 and, you know, hit the bars, and that's all they want to, you know, and get the chow. You know, they don't really care, you know, about anything much further than that. So I can't say that everybody in the military is conscientious and nobody in the civilian world is, right? I mean, you've got a mix of people everywhere. But I think a lot of it is just depends on who you work for and who you're working with, right? Because I know for me, it was I found it easier leading folks, you know, as a bona fide team lead,
mm-hmm.
Or working with my bosses as a bona fide team member than it was to kind of connect with some of my peers. And, you know, it's kind of like in the business world, and like, well, it's like anything else. Everybody wants to prove their worth. Everybody wants to show their stuff.
Yeah.
And so when we have different experiences, you know, people fear the unknown. They're sometimes cynical, you know, they say, well, that's never going to work. And that's only in the military. You can't just force somebody to do it because, you know, they think that in the military, we just order somebody to do it and they're going to do it. I wish leadership was that simple.
Yeah, that easy.
We know it's not, you know, and
right.
Quite frankly, I say, I'm glad it's not, to be honest, because you want to lead because people respect you and have confidence in you, not because they're told to, right? I think the former situation gets you a lot better results. And so that's, I think, where I saw the disconnect, my personal, was in that kind of peer level, you know, for those, you know, for subordinates or for higher ups, it was just a matter of understanding what made them tick and then being able to adapt my leading, my style a little bit, you know, to be able to, you know, not to change myself completely, but to at least be able to speak to them in a way that was, you know, more, allow them to receive it better.
And that's a learned skill though, to be able to perceive that environment like that.
Absolutely. I mean, I remember, you know, long after I was even out of the reserves, you know, so we're talking, it must be about 09 or somewhere around there. I had a team of three analysts working for me. I was working for a brokerage, and I had three distinct personalities. I had one guy that was literally plug and play. I'd be like, hey, Brian, where are we on XYZ project? Like, well, sir, blah, 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 blah. I mean, he would have made one heck of a first sergeant. I mean, he was awesome.
Yeah.
And then we had another guy. He was your typical type B economist, you know, very soft-spoken, not that he had a low self-esteem, but he just wasn't outspoken, right? And he just wanted to do his work. And what made him tick was being appreciated. He didn't care about titles. Of course, he appreciated a raise like everybody else, but he wasn't doing it for the money. He wasn't doing it for glory. He was just a very smart guy that wanted to be appreciated. And then you had a third guy that just didn't have a whole lot of attention to detail that needed to be supervised a lot more closely than I felt comfortable doing. You know, I don't like to micromanage. I don't like to be micromanaged, but unfortunately there are times when it has to be done. And so you had three distinct personalities in the same exact team, the same person in charge. You've got to learn how to adapt a little bit because what works for one is not going to work for the other.
And in what instance did you experience that same kind of difference in the same kind of need to adjust your leadership style in the Marines? Right. Can you think of an instance where you had to do that, where you learned that skill that you applied forward into your work at the brokerage house?
Yeah. You know, I'll go all the way back to MCRD, you know, being a squad leader at
MCRD for those who are listening.
Oh, sorry. Marine Corps Recruit Depot Boot Camp. Marine Boot Camp. Okay. Sorry.
No, that's all right. I'm with you. The audience.
So at Marine Boot Camp, I was tapped to be a squad leader. And it was a position that I held most of the time there. I got fired a couple times, but got rehired and, you know, I graduated as a squad leader as well. And I guess, you know, you go Marine Corps boot camp is 13 weeks long, three distinct phases, not only in terms of what you're doing, but just the intensity level and the amount of managing that the drill instructors do. And they do rely on those squad leaders and the guide who's like kind of like the head squad leader, if you will. You know, you have three squads plus the guide over all of it. And, you know, that's, you know, for a lot of people, that's their first foray in any kind of a leadership role. And so it was literally trial by fire. I mean, there's a time I almost got a fist fight with one of my recruits because he didn't like what I had to say. You know, a drill instructor came and broke it up and we were doing pushups until we both puked. But I mean, you know, and then it was, you know, but then there were other times where a guy was like, and actually, matter of fact, I reconnected with our scribe for the platoon. He was the guy that wrote all the notes. He was like the secretary for the drill instructor.
There you go.
He just retired out of as a lieutenant colonel. And we reconnected on LinkedIn about a year or two ago. And I hadn't seen Dave in I don't know how many years. And he was like, you know, we were laughing about it because he was just like, you know, memories of me, he's like, hey, you were pretty, you know, squared away and you got, you know, things very organized for us and you helped us out. So here, you know, one guy wanted to punch my lights out. One guy was, you know, singing my praises. And, you know, and it's funny how, you know, things, you know, are remembered over time. But leadership is one of those things where I think it's like anything else. You know, you can't just sit and rest on your laurels. There's always something more that you can learn.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I'm not nearly as well read as, you know, some folks like Jim Mattis or somebody like that. But I do like make it a point to read as much as I can, and not just in my field, but in kind of supplementary fields, if you will. See if I can pull in some lessons that might be applicable in one industry that maybe I can make it relevant to this one.
Fast forward, Chris, so to the officer community now, because you have a unique perspective where you have seen both sides of that equation, right? So that instance where you describe these two different personalities and your role in an appointed leadership position on the enlisted side, right? Talk about, or can you give an example of a similar instance where you had to adjust your leadership style based on the situation as a young lieutenant or maybe a young captain?
Well, I mean, I guess at that point, a lot of the egregious mistakes were already made. So, you know, they always say like one of the scariest things is when a second lieutenant meets his platoon sergeant for the first time. It can be intimidating. You know, here's a guy, you're a typical lieutenant, 22, 23, even 24 years old, meets a staff sergeant that's 26, 27, 28 years old, that's been in the Marine Corps for 10 years already. And
mine was in his mid-40s.
There you go. And so it's like, you know, what are you going to tell this guy, you know, what to do? And I think for me, it was drawing upon those lessons and learning how to listen first.
Great point.
Hey, tell me, give me the lay of the land. Who's who? Now, you have to be mindful as the leader. Some people have an axe to grind. There might be some biases and everything else. So when you're gathering this kind of intel, take it with a grain of salt and you can trust but verify kind of a deal.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the day, you'll have to make your own assessment. But it's good to get down there and talk, you know, and get to know the folks. And the same thing with your squad leaders and saying, okay, you know, who is this person? And really taking an active interest. And then the other part is, you know, same thing on the way back up, you know, learning your company commander, what makes him, you know, or her tick. What is, you know, what's really important to them? Maybe getting some, you know, insight from some of the staff officers, some of the other company commanders, you know, at that level. And then with the lieutenants, you know, lieutenants love to talk just as much as Lance Corporals do. And, and so it's kind of like, you know, who are the alphas? Who are the more, you know, soft spoken, you know, who's in it for medals? Who's in it for the glory? Yeah. Who's in it for learning? And I guess there's no magic formula, and it's something that you've got to bring into the civilian world as well. You know, and I think, you know, but bottom line, I think you've got to, there's something to be said about, you know, not being the first one to speak and be willing to listen and kind of learn, at the lay of the land a little bit before you really, dive in.
How do you think that approach to difficult leadership situations has affected you as you stepped into your new role as a farm management specialist at the University of Tennessee, being willing to listen and being able to understand the lay of the land before you kind of step in with both feet? How has that helped you?
I think it's helped me tremendously, because you come in guns blazing and say, hey, you know, all right, sit down, I'm going to teach you everything you need to know. You're going to lose them very quickly. And you probably will either miss a bunch of stuff that's very important, or you'll start talking about things that have absolutely nothing to do with their operation. And then you end up with egg on your face.
Mm-hmm.
And so on these farm visits, you know, I've been, you know, with the Institute for 3.5 months now. But I've been on several farm visits, and the first thing I do is I don't even open up the – I might unpack my gear at the kitchen table, but before I open anything up for the computer or anything like that, I'm just like, all right, I pull out a notepad and a pen and said, all right, talk to me, you know. In some cases, they've, you know, we might have had a phone conversation already, so I might have some initial questions that I start with. But, you know, the first – there's no magic time, but the first part of, you know, of the engagement in person or on the phone for that matter is – just me listening and then maybe asking questions so I understand, you know, make sure I understand where you're coming from. Because from there, then you can say, okay, well, what is important to you? and what do I think is important? Then we can have that conversation too. Say, well, based on what you've told me, this is what I'd like to discuss or work on, but you tell me what you think where you need the help. And because ultimately I'm there to serve them. I'm there to help them. So yeah. I want to make it as relevant as it is to them.
What similarities do you see between the farmers you interact with at the kitchen table and the veteran community?
Well, definitely hardworking, definitely okay. Very driven. A lot of cases don't want to take smack from anybody, but and a lot of them don't like to be told what to do.
Yeah, I can imagine that, right? And so as somebody that steps in as a de facto advisor in an area that maybe matters – farm the economics around their business, right? How are you approaching the communication of bad news, if you will, or the need of a producer to adjust a few things?
Tenderly, very yeah. Tenderly.
Describe that.
It's sort of, their livelihood. One of the first visits that I did was with a farmer. He's just been through so much personal turmoil in recent years, and his farm was losing money, and and actually I was there with the guy that I was replacing, and because he's kind of showing me the ropes, and by the end of it I'm like, what can we tell this guy? Mm-hmm. And it was and the thing was, he knew what was going on. It wasn't like we were telling him anything he didn't already know. We were if anything else we were just confirming it at that point. And but you could see the look on his face, and it was very hard. I'm like, look, we're here to help you. And, here's some of the recommendations we've got. And if this doesn't make sense to you or you don't understand how that works, give us a call. This is what we're here for. And, I'm waiting until after the harvest is done to follow up with him again, because he's got enough on his plate right now.
Right.
And you don't want to, and that's the other thing. You got to find that balance between overwhelming them or being kind of over eager and just kind of on their case all the time versus, stepping back so far that they think you don't care, that you forgot about them, or, it was a one and done kind of a deal. So that's a delicate balance that I'm still trying to figure out, to be honest. But it's, at the end of the day, you've got to be respectful. You've got to be empathetic and you got to be truthful.
Would you agree that you can teach these skills of personality management and leadership and sense of awareness? Can you educate people on these things, or do you just have to sort of be born with them?
No, I'm one of the people who say I don't think that leaders are born. I think they are made. And they're made in one of two ways. One is self-drive, self-interest. They see themselves as a leader, or they for whatever reason that they want to jump into that fray, and they do what they have to do to kind of learn that along the way. The other part is leadership development. I think, leaders are created, not born. And so you have to have a certain amount of, not everybody's has what it takes to be a leader. Not everybody wants to be a leader. They don't want the headache. They just want to do their thing, get rewarded and move on. Others crave it, right? And then the ones that are selected, whether they're selected from one pool or the other, have to be trained up. And I think where it can be education is, you have to allow them to make mistakes, and make mistakes early on when the stakes are lower than later on when the stakes are higher and the consequences are a lot more dire.
I'd like to unpack, if you can, the farmer that you just described at the beginning, or the broader issues that farmers and producers in your area of Tennessee are being affected right now. What are some of those challenges that they're struggling with, generally speaking? Or if you wanted to use that farmer as an example, let's unpack that one more if you can.
Well, up until about a month ago, we've been in a super cycle of low commodity prices.
Sure.
And of course, we've seen the rally in soybean prices, corn has followed suit, wheat as well, And so we're starting to see a reinflation of those prices. And, certainly we were recommending folks to forward contract, hedge, something, do some risk management now, because we don't know when the good times are going to end, right? Because most of the time in agriculture, it's got to be a supply shock before you see any meaningful improvements. Demand can grow, demand can shift. You could have temporary swings, but in the long term, it's really supply driven, right? And so when you have, you know, these farmers, you know, in a low commodity price environment, it's really hard, you know, it's hard to make those operating loans. You know, the ones that are savvy, you know, don't carry a lot of debt. They own their, or they own their land outright, or they've strategically buying new land when it, you know, when interest rates are cheap, or, you know, when they see a good deal coming along. But I think the biggest, and I've talked to some producers out here. I just had a conversation a couple of weeks ago. I stopped in on a farm. Just I was passing through, and I figured I'll take a chance to see if he's at his shop. And we both agree that the biggest challenge, I guess, right now is commodity marketing. You know, how do you, and the risk management part of it, how do you hedge with futures and options? You know, when should you forward contract? How much should you sell off the combine versus put in storage?
Yeah.
Versus resell, you know.
And that matters in the commodity market, irrespective of where it is cyclically. Correct.
Or this idea of, you have to understand where your cost of productions are, right? Because, you know, you don't want to lock in a price pre-harvest that's below your cost of production. That makes zero sense.
Yeah, right.
But at the same time, if you're able to get, you know, cover your costs and maybe get a small profit, you should probably look at selling at least a portion of it. You can always store some and hold off, you know, till after the harvest, to, you know, to catch some price swings or something like that. You know, what we're seeing right now is kind of a contra-seasonal effect, but it's not, you know, so it's not normal. But, you know, you, typically this time of year, you see prices coming down under harvest pressure, and then they come late after the new year, right? And so being able to manage those price cycles, you know, on a seasonal basis.
How are you recommending that producers find that balance right now?
Before I got there, there's been classes that have been given. Texas A&M is actually in the midst of an eight-week master marketing session. We're at UT. We're doing a farm management thing that we just started, where it's not just the marketing, the crop outlooks, but it's also record keeping and taxes and all that kind of good stuff. One of the long or mid-range goals that I have is I'd like to build out a seminar series on risk management and outlooks, and saying kind of like bridging that gap. Okay, this is how, you know, we can understand how market movements and why the market moves and everything else. These are the tools that you have to manage it, and this is how you put it all together. And I think where it's missing is a lot of these educational programs that we've seen in the past do a great job of introducing the mechanics of it, but there's no, to keep it at a military thing, there's no war gaming. You don't actually get to
stand
at the table and say, okay, let's, and that's one of the things that I'd love to be able to do. You know, let's just say it's an 8-week course. Week 7, we're wargaming, 8 weeks, and then we do the, you know, after action report on week 8, and say this is, you know, where we are. And we might be, you just give them like one or two scenarios and say, okay, you know, we let them work at it for an hour. You know, this side of the room is brokers, this side is the farmers. This is the information that each one has. And then we throw in a curveball, you know, an hour into the session and see how they react and everything else. Because, you know, you were talking, you asked me that earlier, you know, how does that education play in with, you know, tie in with the military versus the civilian world, and civilian leadership development, being allowing them to fail. Part of that is, you know, is the gaming exercises that I think are, you know, we used to laugh about them, you know, sitting around a stand table, but you know what, there is a lot of, you know, there's a lot of merit to those things, because it allows you to make mistakes in a controlled environment.
Yeah.
You know, where the stakes are very low and you can actually learn.
Why don't you think those exist in from your experience in the particular line of work that you're in right now?
Well, not so much in my line of work. I think it's just in the professional life that I have. I think part of it is, one is time and resources.
Just not enough of it to create something like that.
Right. Because if your compensation is dependent upon how much sales revenue you bring in, do you want to sit around a sand table or do you want to go out and sell?
Yeah.
Right.
That's the reality of it.
When you, and I've made that observation in the past, that when you create a culture where it is kill what you eat, that's what you get. You cannot expect people to collaborate. You can't have cross product selling. You can't have cross team collaborations or anything like that, because there's no incentive, because they say, well, if I'm doing this, then I'm not going to get paid. And why would I not get paid?
Yeah.
So I think the, The incentives need to be better aligned.
How does a producer get in contact with someone like you at the University of Tennessee and their extension agency?
Yeah, so the easiest way for them to do it is just go to their county agent and say, I want to talk to a farm management specialist. Can you introduce me to the one that's in our area, or have him call me? And, you know, I cover 15 counties in West Tennessee, but we've got six other specialists. We're actually two short right now, so if anybody's looking for a job that has a master's in agricultural economics, let Mike know and he'll get in touch with me. And, you know, we got one in East Tennessee in the Smoky Mountains and one in West Tennessee along the Mississippi River. So whatever your flavor is, we'll get you in.
It's not a bad place to put down roots for sure. You'd mentioned that there are tools that can be used in finding this balance between when to sell, when to hedge, when to hold. What are some of those tools, and are any of them technology?
So, well, technology would be used in all of it. But when I say the tools that you can use, I'm talking specifically about financial products or the like, where you, or contracts or something like that, that are at your disposal. So, for example, forward contracting is selling something before the harvest. So you're selling it at a later date, that's, you know, and then you have, you know, specifications that you need to meet and a discount and premium schedule to go along with it. Futures and options, you know, in the commodity markets is another one where you can hedge your production. And then you have, you know, storage opportunities where you either pay or you have on-farm storage because you know you can sell it later on based on where the seasonality is. But when it comes to, like, market outlooks and looking at the seasonality and stuff, certainly technology will come into play. And there's, you know, there's certainly firms out there that make a business trying to use artificial intelligence or otherwise automate the seasonality or just the long-term cycles of commodities that, you know, they're trying to basically solve that problem or at least have a fair warning.
It's one more, you know, one more sort of final question, if I could, is that of the veteran community that's listening, what would you tell them to do if they are interested in getting into the agricultural space to begin to prepare themselves to be more attractive to the hiring organizations within agribusiness or those kinds of firms? What can they do as a part of the service or while they're still in the service to get them ready?
Well, I mean, I guess I would start with your education level. What do you know? What don't you know? Where are the gaps and how do I fill those gaps? It could be more education if you're, you know, you're enlisted and, you know, you join right out of high school, you know, but you're, you know, interested in agriculture and you like the science aspect of it. Maybe you look at getting a degree in agronomy, soil science. If you like the business aspect, maybe get ag business or ag economics or animal science if you want to, you know, go into livestock production or something like that, right? So if you're an officer and you're, you know, you might have had an undergraduate degree in, I don't know, we'll call it marketing, right? And you want to, maybe you look at some of these companies where that you look at a John Deere, well, maybe an MBA is all you need, you know, because even though they're an ag company, there's a lot of different functions of that that may or may not be production or ag related. Or maybe you really do want to be bona fide ag, so you get a master's of agribusiness instead of an MBA, you know. And just plug our alma mater, Texas A&M, has just got ranked number one in the master's of agribusiness across the country. So there's a good place to start right there.
Yeah.
Actually, had a young Navy lieutenant. She was getting her master's while she was one of the naval instructors there for the ROTC unit. And it really, you know, it's taking inventory, understanding the industry, and then being honest with yourself. What do you need to do to kind of bridge that gap? Other than that, read a lot. I'm a huge proponent of reading and, you know, reading not just those, you know, it feels that you're interested in, but ones that feed into it or maybe that are seemingly unrelated, but you can tie in some stuff that might be more of a general level type of book or something like that. But you can say, hey, you know, I can pick the parallels in and make it work.
Yeah. Chris, true pleasure, my friend.
Hey.
Thanks. Thanks for listening, everyone, to another episode of the Veterans in Ag podcast, brought to you by AGD Consulting. I can't help but come away from this interview with Chris with an appreciation for the breadth of experience he brings to his current role at the University of Tennessee. He's seen agriculture from so many different perspectives: production, advisory, agribusiness, risk, finance, and my hope is that this experience will serve as an example to the listeners out there as to the many different types of opportunities within ag that can be experienced. I was also struck by Chris's description of how his experiences from the service allowed him to break down a situation and begin to develop a solution systematically. This approach to problem solving is ingrained into many service members from early in their training, so it was really great to hear Chris describe how he used these skill sets during his time at John Deere, for example. He also talked about being able to adjust his leadership style to accommodate the needs of several different employees, and how this was a tactic, if you will, that he learned in service and has applied to the private sector. These kitchen table moments also, you know, that Chris describes with farmers, I think is something many veterans miss after they transition. Being able to serve others, being a part of something bigger than yourself. These don't have to be lost when you leave the service. There are places within agriculture where you can find these opportunities. So if you enjoyed Chris's interview and think other military veterans and supporters would benefit from the insights shared by Chris Narayanan, please leave us a review and share on social media. You can also find these episodes and learn more about AGD Consulting by visiting our website at www.desaconsultingllc.com. That's D-E-S-A consultingllc.com, and by clicking on our newsfeed. Finally, if you have any recommendations of future guests who are military veterans or supporters who are leading the way in agribusiness, ag tech, or agripreneurship, send them our way. I'm your host, Mike Desa, and until next time, stay frosty.